Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our regular Wednesday stream. It is actually Wednesday this time.
Hello, it is Wednesday, my
It is
dudes.
Wednesday, my dudes. I put out a friendly frog post to that effect on the on the socials. I do try and celebrate our great frog day of Wednesday. So yes, it is now Wednesday rather than it being Monday, even though I said Wednesday last time.
We're
But that's
back.
good. We're back. We are definitely back though. Well, welcome back to everybody. It's good. It's good. It's good. We're wonderful. It's good to be here.
Yeah,
But
your lovely town is the best town we play in. What was the rest of the stuff we're supposed to say?
I'm not really sure.
We will, however, of course, at the start of the stream, as we usually do, get our shilling out of the way. So thank you to the members, and thank you to people who show up to the streams and watch them regularly, or watching the VODs, which seems to be a decent chunk of people as well.
Yes, there's a decent
We're
chunk.
glad you're interacting with the stuff. And are actually even doing the algorithm summoning comments without even being prompted. So if I
Yes,
prompt them now, there better be more.
I see the algorithm. I see the plus ones. You guys are pretty good with your summoning of the
But
algorithms.
we have the super chats and the super stickers
We're
and
still monetized somehow, despite
yes,
being.
shh. Well, it's because we love the nation of Israel, of
We oh, of
course.
course, we always have to reassert our. Our adoration for the nation of Israel, yes.
Yes. It is the most legitimate of states. We
Ooh.
have the PayPal as well because we don't currently have a Streamlabs thing going on at the moment. I know someone actually mentioned that on Twitter earlier. And on top of that, we also have the Substack, which I'm just going to keep mentioning because every time I mention it, about a week or so later, someone will come along and
There's a
follow that.
lot of
So.
stuff being worked on in the subs. There's a lot of written content that we have in the pipeline. You'll notice that we were quite busy for a while. Like I said, it is something that we do when we have time. But there is written content as well if you guys want to work through it. I'd recommend our backlog, really. Just go through, see the stuff you enjoy, because some of it's quite evergreen. We don't tend to do too much, as we do here, we don't tend to do too much current event stuff,
If
so.
anything, some of it is possibly more relevant than when it was written.
We have this terrible habit, as we do on stream, of basically making stuff about 6 months too early, like our political switcheroo stuff, which is really just bearing fruit now. People are going, oh my God, they're actually switching
So,
places.
yes, please interact with the streams and the VODs and watch the backlog of stuff. And if you think our work is worth it, please consider supporting it so that we know to make more of it and to try and make it better.
Yes.
Because it's a Wednesday. Oh no, I'll mention one last thing as well, and I'll probably mention it towards the end again. For those interested in the impromptu replacement for Nomos, either contact us via the email that you used, to contact about ticket inquiries or anything like that. And let us know if you're interested. We'll probably put something out on it on the email and social media stuff by Friday at the
We will
latest.
have something by Friday. I've been kind of keeping it a bit close, mostly because a few people have had security concerns still, which is
Well,
fair enough.
yeah, no, but if anyone's wondering, we're not just going to like post here's where we are,
We're
like a
not.
week before. We're going to make sure that it's either people we know or people who can prove that they at least bought a ticket.
So we are trying to be. We're trying to balance keeping people informed and being security conscious, as we always try
But
and do.
I think we're probably looking to have maybe no more than, I mean, if we're booking it probably 25 seats, we will probably be at venues that have more space than that.
Yeah,
So
I
if people
would,
want to
yeah.
get in touch with us, it gives us a better idea of numbers and what we can do. But other than that,
We are still trying to do something despite,
yes.
basically refunding everybody and having to cancel the formal part of that event. So we've done enough preamble, I'd say. We're doing kind of the top point, the crescendo of
Yes.
our little mini kind of four stream economics arc here. For those who are wondering, this was kind of planned, but mostly just because all of this is a big tangled knot of
Yes.
effectively the same topic, which is the unreality of the economy. It's something we talked about very, very heavily during our democratization streams about how we got here from 1900s to 1945, the fakening.
Debasement of currency as we separate from the gold standard. The complete reorientation of economic incentives away from profit and long-term goals towards just short-term growth, borrowing to make ends meet for the next day. These are all sort of principles that have developed at least over the last century, if not longer, and have really fully come into fruition. I mean, we maybe see since the 70s or the 80s to the point where we are now. And it's to the point whereby we're going to put forward the argument in this stream, really, that if you are the managerialist, you're controlling the economy, and it's up to you to make it all move and work, at least to some extent. You could make an argument, really, that the vast majority of people that work in some HR role, that work in some civil service role, or, you know, some of the things we'll go on to look at more specifically in a moment, that those jobs are so fake, and that the compliance required on top of them to actually put people in those jobs, you'd be better just turning around to the people in question saying, we're going to pay your wage, you stay at home.
Yeah, we'll be utilising a couple of memes throughout this. The Trailer Park Boys one will be in here as well. But it is, they are reaching the crossover point. And there's a lot of good evidence of this. In fact, I was expecting this when I kind of prototyped it with a few people I talked to, that'd be a bit more controversial. But talking through with a few people, they're like, oh yeah, that actually completely makes sense from their point of view. I will say a quick disclaimer here that we are not ourselves advocating for the model of UBI as an ideal system for cash distribution.
We're trying to get our heads around ultimately maybe one of the practical elements of UBI that I think has gone basically unspoken.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Nathan CJ Hood, there for becoming a member. Again, that is one of the best ways you can support us on a recurring basis. Thank you for becoming a hat tipper. You get fancy little emos for those. So thank you. But we are not just going to be talking about the super duper low hanging fruit style.
Look at my job. What my day at Google.
Look at this.
My day is a product manager at Uber.
He pajit. He sleep. He the sleepy Pajit. But yeah.
He sleep, but he still smell of sheet.
Well, this is a story from kind of the peak tech bubble, which was kind of 2015 to 2019, which is the fact that Google and other places and Apple and all of those and Yahoo decided to have like nap pods in their offices. This is the really, really obvious stuff. And I think this is the stuff that very much takes up the space in the discussion about fake work. Because it's so clownish and cartoonish. Again, it's the woke fake work that is distracting people from the massive amounts of other fake work.
Yes, the real fake work.
it's like chumming the water, basically, and then swimming the other direction. Swimming the other direction. As it's kind of how, as we explain to a lot of people, how the sausage gets made in many cases. Because you have all this tech sector, which we've talked about at length. We've talked about the fakeness of the financial sector, the fakeness of the tech sector, the complete reliance of venture capital on the money printer, the fact that it's all administered by the same people, and the fact that at some point they're going to turn around and go, you know, we're going to bail you out. But the fact that everyone's job is fake is what will make the people's bailout we talked about work.
Yes.
It is the vector by which they have hollowed out the economy and completely abstracted work from production.
Yeah, shall we go over the sort of what the wider framing we have here as well?
Yeah, you've
kind of put the point in the notes, like, in this case, you have 90 IQ. This is not our case for UBI. This is the managerialist case for UBI within their own framework.
Yes, but this, I don't know, I found some very good images of these terrible parody offices.
Does that not look like an efficient office space to you? I bet they get a lot done. That's what they need the slide for.
Going down the fucking slide. I've been in places like this. They are, everyone is universally miserable in them. It's quite funny, but anyway, yeah. The premise we're putting forward is that most people in the UK do not undertake meaningful or productive work. Their work is created by legislation, subsidy, or the knock-on effects from both.
In terms of some sort of compliance because of a legislation or subsidy that in and of itself, we have a new subsidy, therefore we need an office for the distribution of the subsidy. Then we need an office to regulate and make sure the compliance, the distribution of the subsidy is fair. And you just end up with this network effect of layers and layers of just crap built on one another.
Both from the managerial point of view and in practical reality, having people work fake jobs is more resource intensive, more strenuous on resources than not having them work at all.
Yes.
That is just a fact. If you have all these people who are doing all these fake jobs, that is more of a headache if you are a managerialist than having those people just sit home.
And lockdown proved this.
Yes.
Look how easy it was for the regime to engage in complete and utter sort of narrative control. I think you've slightly missed out one of
them. No, this is the next one.
As you had written it.
yeah, you're bringing that in. That'll be the next point we go over. That's true. But before lockdown, even before any of this, well, even before the Second World War, the benefit system and UK unemployment insurance, which was, you know, as we described, really put forward as socialism through the back door by many historians, and at the time people were livid about it. But the benefit system already creates a UBI-like framework in terms of non-work net gain and incentives. The argument for incentives to work have already been lost within the internal managerial policy. They don't care whether work pays or not already. That is already a ship that has sailed.
As well, we can demonstrate that we're not just talking about the situation as it was in the 70s or the situation as it is now, but in the situation as it is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
I mean, go back to the economically inactive stream, and we covered the fact that basically one in four adults in Britain already don't work.
Yeah.
You know, we're not far off a situation where you could say, really, the majority of the adult population not working might actually not change things too much. And this is the point we're trying to make here, is not so much that everyone's going to be unemployed, it's going to be terrible, is that everyone might as well already be unemployed. And if they went and just became unemployed, there'd actually be more resources to slosh around.
Nathan Hood there mentioning John Ruskin. You're the third person to mention John Ruskin today. But same kind of vein. It's the problem is, this stuff, in little isolated pockets, is quite obvious.
Mm.
It's quite obvious that there's a record amount of people on sickness benefit. It's quite obvious that a lot of jobs don't work. But putting it all together puts forward this picture of a completely fake economy with mostly fake jobs. Because the person who washes the windows on the enterprise estate of all the fake tech companies is technically taking part in fake work.
Yes.
He's washing the windows of the fake office. It's like I talked about when I spoke about the military kind of stimulus complex, the military industrial complex working as a permanent stimulus. The wider economy gets filled with all these people who service these fake businesses.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that there is an entire service economy built around servicing people whose jobs are not real. They exist to do the nails of women that work at HR institutions where they provide nothing. They exist to do, you know, the pure gym training sessions for blokes that work at your X, Y, or Z finance company, that all they really do is shuffle around the money for NGOs to help commit crimes better.
Alex Masters brings cutting through the bullshit there. Yes, it's almost like only one person in a household is really required to do any kind of outside work.
Wow, what a novel idea. That totally couldn't have just been the norm throughout the entire of human history or something like that.
Yes, but this is on the background of the mass expansion over the labour pool through women's suffrage. This is on the background of mass immigration, of course. All of these factors compound the fake work epidemic.
Well, see, there's the thing. Alex Mass is saying there's still a massive labour shortage. Is there actually a labour shortage, though? Could you actually, if you had another 10 million people in Britain,
yeah,
that you could, you know, all of a sudden take 10 million people we have now, replace them with 10 million, quote-unquote, skilled people, would there be the resources, the entrepreneurial know-how, or even the general sort of grand kind of macro economic organization to put those people into roles where they could be productive?
It's a very difficult question to answer because we don't know the actual state of things. We assume that they're quite rotted out, and they are quite rotted out, I think, from a lot of the evidence we can glean. But it's not that we have a labor shortage, it's that we have a skill shortage in general. There's plenty of labour, it's just useless.
Yes.
You can't throw labour at problems. Well, labour in the abstract doesn't do anything.
You know, if we start engaging in, before we get to the next slide here, the Pareto kind of effect, whereby, you know, if you have 100 people in a room, the end product of those 100 people, will half of the effort will be done by the square root of the total number. And then you can do that again with your top 10 or your top 50 or whatever. And what I'm trying to suggest is that you know, let's say you've got an economy of, you know, 40 million people working, and you know, your square root and your square root, your square, you keep going and going and going till you get to the top 100 people that are in theory organizing the economy. Are these people even still good enough anymore to actually do that?
Well, the point that we make here is that removing the fig leaf of the benefit system and the fake jobs, admitting that most work is not meaningful, would allow for more efficient managerialism from their point of view. It's a real headache creating all these fake jobs, doing all the paperwork with them, trying to make these people feel like they're meaningful. It's a big problem in the public sector. Many public sector workers are very stressed because they can sense the fact that their job's fake and it makes them nervous. I've been in roles where work has disappeared before, and you've been in that limbo period before the company really realizes that it doesn't need you. And that is always very stressful. But yeah, a UBI system directly is more efficient than a public-private patchwork that prevents people, a lot of P's there, public-private patchwork that prevents people, presents people, sorry, with fake jobs they hate, have to commute to, and are drains on resources. It is, from their point of view, a win-win to put people onto UBI.
And as I sort of was going to point to earlier on, we already have a worked example that tells us that this can be pulled off. We had the 18 months of furlough, which was a trialed UBI program where people from the government decided to do a call to arms and say, for the good of the nation, for the good of the world, you're not going to go to work. And everyone went, okay, as long as we still
You know,
get paid.
if you lie on your couch and eat pizza all day, you're actually a hero. That was what people were told, and it will be what it's what people are also being told about the climate stuff, as we'll get to, as well. So I did move some of the notes around a bit here because they were a bit clunky on screen. So I hope we've not missed anything.
No.
The first background piece I want to talk about is Labour's wealth distribution project. The Labour kind of high-end kick-starting money managerialism of child benefits, of all kinds of new ideas that eventually all got rolled into universal credit. It's funny that people are so upset with that in the Labour Party, because universal credit really, I think, is the end point of the Blairite benefits project. It's the logical extension. It's the everything benefit, and it's the logical extension of their system. But there's just a New Statesman article here talking about how redistributive was New Labour. And it's kind of a key point that though inequality, in quotes, did not fall under Blair and Brown, child and pensioner poverty were dramatically reduced. So within their own framework, they see, I'm not going to an archive version here because I'm not going to read the whole thing. They see Blair and Brown's redistributive policies as a limited success, but not a total success. They see it in managerial terms as them kind of throwing money at a problem and it sticks in some places. You know, child benefit did make it so that single mothers had more money in their pocket. Whether or not that makes a child's life better in that situation is debatable.
Yeah, but as far as they're concerned, from a, you know, the same perspective as looking at GDP statistics and understanding this is the healthy economy, if what you look at is, oh, look, the average household income between this period and this period, you know, the band of the, you know, the top percentile and the bottom percentile closed, and the average moved up by such percentage. As far as the managerial mind is concerned, that is a success.
There's a lot of frustration within the Blair project still about the middlemen and about the lack of ability of the middlemen to provide the outcomes that they want, even when given infinite money. You see that within NGOs and a whole bunch of globalist insiders. They are frustrated visibly to a great degree that they are not able to throw money at a problem and make it go away. So they're trying to build up these very, very complex systems like UBI that will mean that things go where they're supposed to. It really is them just going, right, we're going to try and leverage technology to create a system where we just directly give people things, and we'll see if it changes then. Because right now a lot of the failure is blamed on the middlemen.
And if you weren't aware already, I mean, this is basically, I think there's been a rewrite of this headline in the papers for decades, really, of a roughly one half of people get more from subsidy than they do get in tax, which when you actually work it out becomes even more weighted on the subsidied side, because some of these people's wages and the money they spend is also on government services that can't really be valued anyway. So if you took all the stuff that came out on a wash, you would actually have something like 30 or 40% being the only people that actually contribute.
It's funny that it becomes perfect democracy mess.
Yes.
What you have is you have 51% of benefactors and 49% of losers. And that's how you hold a popular coalition together. It is like the 51% kicks the 49% meme. The numbers bear it out in reality. But there's a lot of this. This is almost like a reread as well of some of the why isn't Britain working stuff.
Mm.
He talks about the the jobs crisis in quotes also taking place during an illness crisis and all of these work related crises when we talked about why no one was working. But this is a repeat really of something that we've known since the mid 2000s, which is more than half of Britain is subsidised by the productive work of the rest of Britain. It's very Pareto. It will end up as probably a Pareto distribution if you look at it hard enough. But you just end up with a situation where there is this mass subsidy going on.
It works perfectly. 10% account for half. The square root accounts for half.
Yeah, exactly. But it's very much a situation in which there is de facto a UBI-style redistribution going on, but via 15 different kind of abstract means. There's just another one here. Record number of Britons receiving benefits that amount to more than they pay in tax. Study finds Civitas, 83% of all income tax is paid by 4% of British adults. Again, very Pareto.
This sort of just presumes that the other 60% basically contribute nothing.
Which is probably true. That's just a second headline, so we're not just going off, it's the Daily Mail. We like to double up sometimes on these just so we can show that this is something that has been reported by the media as a neutral fact,
and
in quotes.
At the other end of this, you have a government policy that's attempting to actually further limit the amount of aggregate available work hours available on any given day.
I think the heaviest lead into UBI, and we show this basically every stream because it's so relevant in so many ways, is the four-day week pilot. If people were undertaking meaningful, non-fake work, then they wouldn't need to pilot a four-day week because you would be working productively in all your hours. If anything, the government would be asking employers to make people work on a Saturday.
Mm.
If the opposite would be true, if Britain had a genuine productivity issue, which is how it is communicated in a lot of the government literature, productivity, Britain's productivity, productivity, how do you get productivity up? Well, apparently you get productivity up by removing a work day.
This is also just compliance with new EU law by the back door to make sure you're not working more than 35 and a half or 37 and a half hours a week.
Someone says 4-day work week may be enough to bring some people back into work. Well, those people were never going to work anyway. If you need a 4-day work week to be mentally capable of working, then you are too disabled to undertake
your
meaningful work.
Your job isn't real.
Yeah, I'm going to say, it'll lure people back to the fake jobs, but nobody worries about this in real jobs.
No.
A lot of the jobs I work have been extremely frustrated by the EU Working Time Directive because it's just a headache for everybody involved.
We already know that the 40-hour work week wasn't a 40-hour work week because nobody works on Monday like they do in the rest of the week, and then Friday's a half day. So when you have the 4-day week, it's really about a 3-day week because you've got half a productive day on Tuesday because that's your new Monday. You've got Wednesday and Thursday, and you get a half day on Friday.
It's also very how does the fake versus real break by gender? I would probably say that majority of women's work is fake. Apart from caring work, the caring professions where
the nursing stuff is probably one of the only places where there is actual service work that could be considered real. And the only reason that has to be propped up as a massive multi-billion pound industry because they can't just allow women to stay at home.
Well, this the contents talk about introduction trial format. Basically, government has trialed what government wants and found that the government has done the right thing by the government.
That's good of them.
Well, they basically just said that they can remove a work week without productivity falling, which shows that all of the workplaces they trialed this in were fake workplaces.
What's that, that bottom Resisting the idea that the 4-day workweek must be one size fits all, each company designed a policy tailored to its particular industry, organizational challenge, departments. A range of 4-day weeks were therefore developed, from classic Friday off models to staggered, basically any way they can convince a company to not
remove the hours, any way you can. The
thing is, this will of course be a paid or subsidized or incentivized program when it's fully launched. The government will say, don't worry, I know, you know, Steve's only working 4/5 of the hours you had him working before, and therefore is only providing you 4/5 of the production he did, so you would want to rightfully only pay him 4/5 of his wage. So instead, we're going to guarantee you that extra fifth of the wage, and we'll pay it.
Well, they also just don't isolate factors here. It's a very, very flawed study.
Remember, one of the components in one of the UBI papers we looked at quite a while ago,
yes,
very explicitly stated that they would adjust wages using UBI to make up for work that wasn't available in situations.
Well, a lot of this has also been predicated on putting women back in the home, which, in a very roundabout way, they're kind of admitting that all of this stuff has created a situation where the care industry, in quotes, cannot live up to the demands of these families. And really, the 4-day work week is about putting a woman back in a home one day a week a lot of the time.
Mm.
Or, you know, putting a parent back in a home. It really is stressed towards that. There's a lot of work-life balance stuff up there. We're not going to read it in detail because
We don't care.
Yeah, we don't like getting stuck in the weeds. Disinterested, interest and control, blah, blah, blah. Work culture. When you realize that that day has allowed you to be relaxed and rested, it's like a well-being thing. The conclusions really are, as the 4-day work week continues to spread around the world, a wide range of benefits has been touted by those making the shift to shorter hours. From the improved well-being and productivity in the organizations and employees undertaking the change, to improved recruitment and retention among staff, and even improved revenue. It turns out, when everything's fake, it doesn't matter if you work on it doesn't matter if you work or not.
Yeah. Which is basically the whole crux of the point of this stream.
Well, it's just, it's very funny that we would get stuff like this. Because in a manufacturing environment, it's a non-starter. Well, we'll get to that later.
I was going to say, and the other end of this, which is the next source you've got, I don't know if you've got this.
Thank you, Ratface, for the $2, saying providing value for work was good. Fake value equals very gay. Yes. So, retailer open 4 days makes the same price. Yeah, it really is them telling you not to believe your lying eyes.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, when they're not trying to take work away from you directly, they're trying to take the work that you've got left away from you by giving all your retired employees the right to strike to have a work from home policy.
Well, there's also a plan here from the incoming Labour government, and we will refer to them as the incoming Labour government because everybody knows that's what's happening. I'm reminded, really, not to, I don't want to dunk on anybody here, because it was an amicable discussion. When I used to stream with Rose of Dawn, and she was talking about the fact she didn't see how Labour would ever be politically viable again. And I just said, well, who else are people going to vote for when the Conservatives run out of political capital?
Yeah.
who else are they going to vote? It was a little bit of an awkward moment at the time, but I wish I could find that clip because I just sound like fucking Nostradamus now. Eventually, the Conservative Party runs out of political capital, and then the Labour Party is naturally cycled in.
I think this is really a monumental thing for them to come out and say.
Yeah.
That not only, you know, are we into the sort of union activism that happened, you know, a century ago or during the 70s or during the 90s, any specific example you want to pick out, or the strikes we have now, but putting forward this idea that not only can you strike for some work conditions you don't like or pay, you can now strike because the government is going to guarantee the right that you can be productive from your own home.
Yes. The idea is that you can be productive whilst working less hours, and you can be productive in any environment, which really means that your productivity doesn't actually matter.
And the whole thing here is obviously that this is aimed as, you know, down with the man, down with the capitalists. But the only way that a policy like this would be achievable would either be the shutting down of massive swathes of industry, or completely reorientating so many industries through some sort of technocratic solution that allows you to be productive from home that isn't just Zoom or Teams or something like that?
It's very likely if your job can afford to have you both work from home and work 4 days a week that you are not working a real job.
No, you're not working at a lathe.
No.
You're not, chopping down large amounts of tree or tilling soil or tending to, you know, a pasture of animals or anything like that.
See, I am allowed to, in theory, work from home, but that's mostly a pat on the head for the fact that I get sent all around the UK multiple times a week.
But that's also, though, a consequence of the fact that you're in an incredibly highly specialised industry, and only through large amounts of technological trickery and, in some senses, abstraction, are you able to provide productivity to people on a work site that are there on the day. If there wasn't all these complex networks around that, you would have to be there physically drawing and measuring things up and this, that, and the next.
Well, I do. The thing is, I do. It's a bit of a fiddle, but I just end up out of the house about as much as I would do if I was working in an office, to be honest with you, these days. When we're busy enough, I need to go here, there, and everywhere, and that's just the reality of it. I couldn't do this 4 days a week.
Plus, I mean, it's not... It doesn't match up with the norm or any of the examples we're picking out, though, is what I mean.
I don't know. Well, people are saying careful. Nothing I've said is anything personally identifiable. It's extremely broad. There's thousands of job types that fit that mold. So do not worry. I'm not revealing anything that would identify who I am there. But it is a real indicator that, really, I think these are the one-two punches that the majority of work undertaken in the UK is fake. Even before we look at, like, the really bad stuff. This is the high level rhetoric. Sorry, that they're putting out themselves that says we know it's fake.
Mm.
They know that we know even as well. But down with the man, up with the providers. He says that the macro shape of the UK economy shows both the exponential rise in the nebulous service sector and what has been flat in terms of industrial output since the 1970s, despite population rise and now massive and undocumented population. So do keep in mind, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the fact that the UK population is very likely a lot higher than is advertised.
Scrump is a Deliveroo driver called Mohammed. He works in the same taxi office as Sajid Javid.
You bloody, bloody.
Bloody bastard, bloody.
I'm sorry your food's cold. I spent 20 minutes shouting you bloody bastard at my boss and eventually just did what he wanted. that is British Indian culture right there.
But yes, there has been no new industry, no new production. I mean, I mentioned it earlier on.
These numbers are from 2016, but I can't find good visual charts that are newer than this.
Well, of course you can't.
But
as you mentioned sort of earlier on, when we were talking about this stuff, the last real attempt to have any industry in the UK was sort of in the 1970s, and the best thing we got out of that was like Leyland and bits of British Rail. And where is that now?
Well, here we go. Here's UK, agriculture, construction, all of that stuff. Coming GDP coming from services, I believe, as a percent of GDP. So in 1948, services, in quotes, of the entire economy was around about 45% of GDP. And even then, even in 1948, Britain was in dire post-war straits.
Yeah, 1948 was a very bad time.
This is under the first National Labour government with its own majority.
Yes.
This is during the time the NHS was being set up.
This is also during the time of the post-war rationing.
Yes. This is also the period in which the problems of socialist Britain was written, about the problems of socialist Britain. Britain at this point is considered internationally a struggling socialist country.
Yep.
That is creaking.
Well, 1948 is the year that de Juvenel writes The Problems of Socialist England.
Yes, that's what I talked about. Yeah. It's reeling from its defeat at the hands of America in World War II.
We'll leave that there.
Yes. It's a great way.
But even by their own figures, this is damning.
JD £5 says, my old company was in London, my boss was on the coast, she was in once a fortnight, I regularly finished at 1 hour after contracted hours. It really is just Nobody's tracking it. It's just the money's there. Things get done. Nobody really quite knows. The economy, even to the managerial class, has become an opaque box.
As long as somebody pays the interest on it.
Yeah, I believe very strongly that they are grasping for this control because they do not feel that they can keep going with the interest rate levers anymore.
No.
They've run out of macro room, which is why you need all this micro fiddling that's starting to go on. Because they've actually started to realize what the Austrian school tells you, which is you have to go down to the individual level and start analyzing what people are doing. Otherwise, you don't know what the economy is made up of. But that's a wider discussion that has already been had, and I'm sure a lot of you are already on board with. So, but this shows you as well, just the construction stays roughly identical throughout post-war British history in terms of a percentage of GDP, at least on paper. The figures put out stay the same.
See, is that...
But the productiveness apparently goes down.
It's GDP in terms of construction. Now, that might mean the final sale of buildings.
Yes, it does.
Relative to the price of everything else.
Yeah.
Which means that purple bar actually has no relation to the total number of buildings.
We'll get to that. We will actually get to that.
I'm just making the point now, though. Or the total amount of materials used, or the total number of people employed. It is actually just, here's the value product at the end of that year produced by the construction sector.
Well, here's basically is a chart of how fake the economy is.
Yeah.
The economy in 1948 is about 48% fake. In 2013, it's about 78% fake. Because, you know, services are quite nebulous. No one can quite tell you what they do. But production is production. You can't fight
the
fact that you need...
You can.
What?
Because what you do is you produce things, say, for military purpose.
Oh, yeah.
For purpose for the NHS. You produce elements of either agricultural or maritime products that have a fixed price on them. You know, there is so many ways you can pick apart these statistics. I imagine it'll be the same with the next set we're looking at.
Well, it's just, I love that. The percentage of workers in the service sector rose from 33% in 1841, basically the height of like Britain being over-teched. Mm-hmm. Like, they were just going around bits of China laughing at people in ironclads because they were 3 centuries ahead of them in terms of technology. It was hilarious. But 33% in 1841 and 80% in 2011. That should show you really the decline. Agriculture and fishing has been decimated. Manufacturing is completely gone. Construction has fluctuated on paper, but seems to have shrunk. So does energy and water even. Energy and water, after the 90s, has shrunk massively because it was effectively nationalised.
Yep.
Those of you who don't know, Britain's energy infrastructure has been a wink and a nod in terms of nationalisation
for a very long time. Look at the real telling one to me there is that in 1841, one-fifth of people worked on the land or directly on the sea.
Yes.
In 2011... Is that 2%? 1 in 50? So 1 in 5 to 1 in 50. It's an order of magnitude difference on
yes,
this front.
Yes, it is. Again, that means that people are abstracted from the means of land production.
We shan't bore everyone to death with graphs, though.
No. There's a couple more here. Public sector employment as a percentage of total employment. Here's an interesting point, though, that technically the public sector on paper has been shrinking. Because, as we know, the direct employment is being replaced by the public-private partnership model. The measures by which we judge productivity, by design, do not factor out jobs that do nothing. It simply divides goods by services by the official population.
What you could be looking at, let's say, from 2008 to 2022 is 1 million people who used to work for the NHS are now 1.5 million people that work for Cordia.
Yes, or Serco.
Yeah.
Because Serco is the everything company, including prisons, housing, the NHS, all of that stuff. There'll be links down the bottom when we're done. We tend to put the show notes in the pinned comment, but yes, we will be linking all of our sources. You can have a good rifle through them yourselves to satiate your statistics autism. But that's a good one. Again, that was the best one I could find.
Yeah. We've got just a quick link here to Mises piece on GDP for anyone that wants to go back to it.
Yes.
Those who are familiar with the democratization series will know that we have done the problems of economic abstractions to death.
We have.
We'll leave that one and allow those again who want to have a look.
If you want something to bite into that's quite meaty in terms of the Keynesianism stuff, watch our Keynesianism special stream.
Yes.
From really a couple of years ago now, Christ. A lot of our groundwork was done a couple of years ago. We do try and talk about economics because it's very important. And it's very important in the political sense here, as we're talking about. But the GDP is an abstraction. GDP is faker than these jobs are.
The example I think he uses in this one quickly is just that, you know, GDP is like looking at someone's caloric intake as the only factor to determine whether or not they're healthy.
Yeah, Bobby Chris says, fertilizers make crop yields four times higher. Yeah, and it also destroyed the soil four times faster.
Yep.
And removed the nutrients from food when I was scrabbling to put back in. But anyway, the problems of industrial farming will be another stream at some point, as well as the... I might just do a whole one on like seed intellectual property, because that will actually terrify people.
Oh, wait, do you find that you can't... that Monsanto have bred out seeds that perpetuated themselves?
gross domestic product. Gross domestic product is such like a macro brain empiricoid thing. I always find it so funny. How do you measure the entire production of a country? You can't.
You add up the prices of all the goods that are sold at the end of the year.
Oh dear, is this Activity UK?
Their website. Oh, is that their website not died? I thought it had for a second.
No. That was it dying for a second there. The Institute for Economic and Social Research has a piece here that focuses on the fact that jobs are all fake, but by couching it as a productivity crisis, you will see the fake work epidemic talked about as the productivity crisis, in that, you know, the UK is growing, but things aren't being produced. And for those of you who were wondering about the numbers in terms of manufacturing, we'll get to that in a second, don't worry. I've seen it been mentioned in chat a couple of times. But as noted in the independent assessment by the NIESR, the danger with the government growth plan is that it would primarily benefit the most affluent areas, thus deepening the disparities instead of levelling up the poorer regions in the country. So even when we're in a supposedly kind of like work emergency situation, equity
is still
the driving principle, which shows that they don't really consider it an emergency. They consider it some level of normality. The government have argued that it's time for a new growth plan. How bad has UK productivity growth been since the financial crisis, both relative to the past and to other countries? Basically, they go through and talk about the fact that Britain never really recovered from the financial crisis, which is true. That part is true. But the stuff that they talk about in terms of, you know, oh, not giving people opportunities, training, basically they talk about Blairism as the cure to all ills.
Well, I see some in the chat being like, we're a service economy, basically a state of serfs. No, the serfs had their own land, which they tended to and could pass on to their own children in their name. They do not spend their time tied to a machine or a laptop or doing someone else's eyebrows 4 hours a week if somebody's living.
Yeah. They also don't get micromanaged by the Lord either.
No.
They have a whatever work week they think they can get away with and still grow crops.
Well, like the serf is like in his hut with his wife and his kids. He doesn't have to worry that like a roving gang of Muslims is going to break in and take his children.
And if they do, there's this guy called Vlad who's going to come and sort them out.
Yeah.
the Hungarians, walk so we could run, basically. there's a reason we kept sending armies out there and we're like, oh, thanks, guys. There's some relief. Blackpilled dinner lady.
thank you.
Did labor decimate manufacturing? It's funny that a full fact article essentially trying to play a rear guard action to the Labour government is the best source I can find on basically post-war production stagnation.
Mm.
The decline of manufacturing. Manufacturing gross value added GDA as a proportion of UK value added. Basically, that's to do with GDP. So this is a sum of manufacturing as a percentage of GDP. So,
well, it's gross value add, so this is value technically added throughout the chain. It's calculated Very slightly differently, but it's roughly an abstraction in the same form.
Yeah, unironically, who there is growing food? Basically nobody. We have a massive food crisis here.
There's warehouses where Albanians are growing unbelievable amounts of weed, and that's about as much agriculture goes on in Britain.
Yeah, we have lots of green, but not those kind of greens. basically, what they show here is that 80%, 10%, they basically say it's a long-term decline, which it is. This is the manufacturing gross value added in terms of 2011 prices. So the inflation adjustment is doing a lot of the heavy lifting here. But really what we see is it bobs up and down a bit. But manufacturing output since 1970 in Britain has been largely flat.
Think of what's going on with not just the level of production, but the things that are themselves produced.
Yeah, that's the next step.
We could guarantee that in 2010 compared to 1970, the number of things that are being produced for some form of government program or government contract where the price is adjusted to suit, not the price being set by some kind of market force, is much more likely.
What we're saying here really is that, yes, manufacturing is more likely to be a less fake job area, but it has been level since the 1970s, and as the easy credit eats into the economy's realness, in quotes, what is being manufactured is abstracted away again.
Well, yeah,
a lot of the manufacturing also is fake.
Alice is pointing that in chat, but weapons being a big part of it, we're maybe not so much guilty as Americans are on that front, but I wonder how much of that, say, $145 billion in 2010 was either the Eurofighter procurement program or BAE system ships.
Yes, there's also a lot of centralized production that goes into, say, cars that is done at a loss. There's a lot of production in the UK that is not economically viable and is done for nakedly political reasons.
We've lost the big Ford plants.
Yeah.
We've lost the big Vauxhall plants. We've lost even the Nissan and the Peugeot and the Honda stuff. There's like those Ineos Grenadier things get made in the UK and Ariel Atom, and that's about it.
Well, as the UK population has ballooned from 1997 onwards, the production in raw terms has declined.
Well, yeah, this is the other point that you sort of hinted at earlier, which is, well, okay, this is maybe true if the population is actually like 75 to 80 million people, but what if it's like 95 or 100 million? These statistics should all be...
As a percentage of real population, factoring in all the people that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, all the mobile phone contracts, all the sewage, all the... supermarket buying, all the stuff that indicates that the population is a lot higher than they're saying it is, this becomes a lot worse. This gets a lot steeper and things get a lot more grim in terms of percentage. Another point I would make in terms of manufacturing before I move on as well, that manufacturing is supposed to be easier in terms of population and like force multiplier. We have more technology now and especially more automation. Therefore, this really should be going up hugely when it comes, you know, the population shouldn't really matter.
Well, you could have a flatlining situation where the only situation possibly you could theorize where it would be flatlining would be where you hold population consistent.
Yeah.
The level of technology increases.
Yes.
The currency itself isn't debased.
Yeah.
So that as the technology becomes more efficient, you actually have a deflationary pressure on the prices of goods that are produced in these industries, and that you would actually see the numbers would be going down for that reason. But we know that's not true because the state of technology isn't getting better, the total number of people is actually increasing, and we have the opposite case money-wise, and it's being debased day on day.
It's a weird one here where they do a per-head thing. I'm not quite sure what's caused that disparity, but that looks a bit funny there. They talk about the rise of China, the UK's decline internationally in terms of manufacturing, blah, 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 blah. All stuff that we know. But I just wanted to go through the numbers in terms of manufacturing because per capita, it has been an extremely rapid decline. And we hit our theoretical maximum in terms of production in the 70s and have not been able to exceed it.
No.
That is a major failure of managerialism. If this is very much following the model of a Soviet economy, in that they hit a ceiling, they try and throw labor at it, and they are unable to raise that ceiling because of it is the management itself that is causing the problem. It is not a lack of labor or even really a lack of resources. It's a lack of efficient management that is taking place. And efficient management can only happen by those who have an interest in increased production in a genuine sense. So that's, it's very kind of Austrian economics 101 there, but that's what's causing that. This is an area I want to drill into pretty deeply.
Just watch, we're already at 50
minutes. No. Compared to the other areas, in that the UK construction industry is something that has been failing in terms of the output for the money that's put in it. Because you've seen there's a stable level of investment, as you can call it, from, you know, percent of GDP. That's the investment.
It's kind of just like something chat. Abdul on his chicken chaser delivering McDonald's will fix this.
Yes, the line will go up.
He's chicken chaser.
But there's an article here from 2018, and they talk about the UK construction industry having its Uber moment. Off-site modular manufacturing is the solution to sector's productivity problems. Basically, they're trying to bring in magic technology because they've realized that throwing Romanians at work sites doesn't build buildings. In February, the model of off-site manufacturing increasingly seen as a solution to the construction industry's stubbornly poor productive record, which, unlike other sectors, has barely changed over the past two decades. Productivity growth in the UK construction's averaged only 0.4% year on year. So they're basically talking about the fact that it's really, really hard to fake the fact you're putting up a building.
Mm.
That's where the construction industry has been derided as being in a shambles, because it is one of the truest reflections of the UK's capacity for work. And it is a poor reflection on it. Uber moment. Productivity, blah, blah, blah. Construction and building, whole economy. Again, this is a very good indicator that the numbers are fake.
Oh, scroll up for a second there. Technology giants such as Amazon and Google are already circling the industry, with the online retailer buying a flat pack house builder in California last month, and Google's parent company Alphabet buying factory-made homes for employees and launching a development project in Toronto through a subsidiary, Sidewalk Labs.
By the way,
so is the US security state then?
Basically, yes. But also, the funny part is, I don't have any of the links here, but if you look into it now, the arse has fallen out of all of this.
Mm.
All of this was a pipe dream. It was ridiculous. It is completely, completely not going to happen. Modular buildings are not coming, because the exact problem you think with them happens in is transport. How do you move these modular buildings around? You don't.
It's almost like we came up with this idea of bricks and mortar at some point.
Robots to be used as bricklayers.
Oh, no.
It's so fake they had the CGI. It's not actually been done yet.
Are they going to give the robots like Mexican names?
Factory producer. Basically, they're talking about magic technology fixing the problem with the fact that, despite throwing more and more money at it, the UK can't actually produce more houses and buildings. And that's a real sign that the service industry, you can fake it. The construction industry, you can't. And that's why it's been flat, despite population changes. A wider discussion with this is the point that there was an actual delineation of who is a key worker and who is not a key worker within the economy. I know it's something you want to talk about, so I'll let you take over here.
I mean, we could... I hadn't mentioned it at all, to be honest, but I mean, the point that comes to my mind would be that the distinction is more important than who they're distinguishing as key and not key.
Yeah.
That putting forward this notion of one subset of labour is important and another one isn't is probably the precursor to turn around to large swathes of people and be like, well, your work is unproductive and harms the environment.
Yes, there is the point, the seed I want to plant here is that the lockdowns were a great work example of how this is already happening, and that the government was able to turn around to a whole bunch of people and say, you are not an essential worker, your work is not essential, which implies that it is a net drain. And basically, just going to the fact that, you know, health and social care, education and childcare, key public services, food, utility, farmers, transport, basically people who do jobs, or at least people who we like to think do jobs.
It doesn't perfectly line up with the distinguishment we would put on it, but I think just the fact that they're making a distinction in the first place is more important.
Well, this is the actual guidance itself. It was withdrawn, but basically it's the same list here. Those at risk of becoming neat, blah, blah, blah. Basically, they just go into saying, look, guys, we know most of the economy is fake. We would like to keep the non-fake part going, please.
Wait, that's kind of funny. They say that what was the at risk of being a neat? What is that section about there?
vulnerable children and young. Basically, they talk about, you know, you have to fulfill both categories. You have to be a key worker with a vulnerable child to send to school.
Ah, right.
So that's the whole thing. They're talking about who can and can't.
Oh, this was when they were talking about who can and can't.
Children of critical workers and vulnerable children who can access school for educational settings. This is the only guidance the government put out, by the way, as an actual list of critical workers.
Yes.
It was completely opaque by this point. And as you said, it was right. It was merely a concept. Alice, a little thank you for the £5 there, saying George Sorrell said in 1908 that the middle class are technology... see technology as a kind of mill that produces science which solves all possible problems.
Yeah, pretty much. It stops them having to do the nitty-gritty or the dirty work of bursting their knuckles solving a problem for real.
Well, this is kind of part of them putting the woke pod away.
Wow, that's... how did I not catch that title when I was reading the notes earlier
Were
on? That's
Chief
brilliant.
Diversity officers set up to fail. Recent exits indicate this could be the case. Where chief diversity officers, you know, facing
the children yearn for the mines.
Facing burnout and a lack of executive support, many diversity, equity, and inclusion leaders have quit. 60% of chief diversity officers at S&P 500 companies left their position between 2018 and 2021.
Do you see anyone on Twitter celebrating that? You think they would, wouldn't you?
No, a lot of people on Twitter seem to be insistent that this isn't happening, that it's only increasing. In terms of corporate governance, diversity, equity, and inclusion officers are going by the wayside and have been for quite a long time.
Scroll down for a second there.
Companies pledged to do better.
The murder of George Floyd in the summer of 2020 was the catalyst in the Black Lives Matter movement that caused companies to think serious about DEI, many for the first time. At least 60 public companies appointed their first ever diversity leader. DEI became a function of HR. Consultants were required to see hiring practices. As if basically them saying, like, well, this all blew up, like, over the last few years and has already blown up in its own face.
As I said, fake work is not a woke phenomenon. Fake work is a post-war phenomenon that has nothing to do with woke, who make up a tiny percentage of hires at very specific organizations, most of which have already left. The fake work is not the tech worker and the diversity worker. That is a distraction. The fake work is the large parts of the accounts and HR department.
I think someone in the chat's just made like the 300 IQ joke. Yeah. I'm at work RN. What kind of insult is this?
Bravo, sir. Bravo. That's very funny. But no, I want to unwoke jacket fake work. That is one of my main missions here. Compliance monitoring and enforcement activity 2021. This is from the Environment Agency, but this is a microcosm of the rest of England, in that a massive section of the fake workforce deals with compliance.
Mm.
If you have a job that is fake but pretends to be real, there are about 7 other jobs around it that are purely based on health and safety, compliance, governing bodies, some of your diversity, equity, inclusion stuff, but mostly just trying to comply with the
wider
law.
Work legal. Ethics.
Yeah. Mm. Legal. You know, labor relations in many industries.
Public relations.
Public relations. All of that stuff balloons around these fake companies. The Environment Agency published in 2021 policy and monitoring targets in the packaging produce responsibility monitoring plan. In 2021, using desk-based monitoring, monitored all registered products, compliance schemes, and accredited reprocessing exporters. We audited a total of 251 persons. Talking about the COVID-19, using an intelligence-led and risk-based approach, suspended 10. They basically
scroll
just,
back up for a second. Yeah. There. 600 over the year, our various interventions have resulted in disrupting approximately 600,000 tons of weight, with an estimated package recycling note value of £11.5 million.
What regard is legitimate evidence? They're talking about the fact that their compliance officers went out and caught people not doing the fake recycling right. But I just wanted to get this up as an example of just the micromanagement and the number of state agents out there. In a single year, they audited 251 people. There's probably more than one auditor per person doing that. So that's like 500 people out there waving their fingers at the fake green recyclers they've got, saying they're making it too obvious that it's all getting burnt in China. Another worked example of the rise of compliance over frontline workforce is the UK police. We've talked about the UK police before and the fact that they have become an extension of the intelligence services. While the, you know, there's two police forces. There's a police force for the, of the elite, and there's a police force. The anarcho-tyranny aspect is that we just get laughed at. Go and watch our policing streams if you want more about those. But there is a great graph. I need to find it here because it really just shows what's been happening in terms of the
police. Is this the trend of, you know, yeah, yeah, officers designated for actual policing work relative to PCSOs, well, and people who do desk work?
Special constables, as in, like, special constables are generally the people who go out and do, like, the hard edge shit.
Yeah.
If you're like a, you know, an SP, you are somebody who goes and does stuff. And PCSOs as well, generally they're not the best indicator, but they are seen as an indicator of visible frontline police force.
But we know they're all like the fat middle-aged women coppers that aren't going to stop anybody.
I think that is the chart I was looking for. So here we go. There's been a slight kind of removal and rebounding, but as special constables and as PCSOs have basically halved in number, the amount of policing staff, in quotes, has reduced and then risen again to stay level around about 80,000. This is a huge gulf in terms of people who go out and do policing and effectively what are admin workers. This really shows you that, what is this, 7 out of 8 police workers are effectively desk jockeys. Or we don't quite know what they're doing because they're not special constables and they're not some like a PCSO.
It's more like 8 out of 10, but yes.
Yes, yeah. 8 out of 10, basically. Again, the magical 80-20 rule. So we found here that 20% of the police force is doing all the policing, or at least in the community sense. And we have police staff and designated officers. They're the Indian ones. I think a designated officer would be somebody from a South Asian background. But
probably.
Absolutely designated. Yeah,
the moral police or whatever.
But that is a good example of just the fakeness. In the, again, 80-20, we found the Pareto distribution. UK Tech Centre retains number one spot in Europe and number three in world. The sector resilience brings
Woo-hoo,
continued growth.
Get the banners up. Mission accomplished. We are the fake work utopia.
So we are the fakest economy in Britain. the fakest economy in Europe. Britain is the fakest economy in Europe. Combined market value of $1 trillion that does complete of, you know, high-end cat food and juice squeezers.
Yes.
It's the same here in the UK as in the US. In fact, it's even more tin pot here because we are pretending that we are still some kind of superpower whilst being, you know, bonkers new Britain, Boris, please help us, bonkers, bonkers, Stormzy, bonkers, oh no, my house has been
This
robbed.
Is why you shouldn't trust the, or at least shouldn't instantly trust the scores and scores of people in our community that are tech bros, because they think they're like real hard-working people with like machismo who are these 50s, like Mad Men office-style folk, and they're actually like pathetic keyboard warriors. And the only reason they know anything about this sphere is because their fake job allows them to listen to 30-plus hours of podcasts in a week.
I will say that every single bugman has a fake job.
Yeah.
You can't have a real job and be a bugman.
Well, the thing I've noticed is that I am, for all intents and purposes, unemployed. I do not have the time to keep up with a number of podcasts and shows that people I know and are seen who supposedly work 40, 50 hours in tech companies have.
Yeah.
All I do is like housework and errands and go to the shops and a bit of reading and this, that, and the next thing. And I have less time than these people do. It makes no sense.
I don't think they're doing anything. That's the whole thing. I couldn't sit and like actually listen to a podcast whilst working.
No.
I can't even really listen to music. I generally have to sit, you know, in relative silence and concentrate on a complex technical task.
Even I'm making food and stuff like that, I don't want to put something on I'd have to focus on, because then I'd either wouldn't cook the food properly or I'd just miss half of what I'd be trying to listen to. But we'll wrap it up here, because we need to come round back to how this connects to UBI.
Yeah, I think we have like roundly beaten up the UK, you know, the real jobs and the fake jobs. I think we have presented enough evidence to show you that the vast majority of work undertaken in the UK is, in essence, fake. But there's a... The switch will come, like I said, when they try and sell people on how fake their own jobs are. And part of that is the, again, New Labour, New Britain stuff. They're talking about not UBI, but a minimum income guarantee, which is very similarly worded to the minimum infrastructure guarantee.
Well, scroll down here for a second. Labour. I think they have UBI mentioned in the third paragraph here.
What if everyone was on universal credit? Everyone should have a decent standard of living in one of the world's richest countries. Here's how we make it happen. This, by the way, is the equivalent. This is like the New Labour think tank or the Labour think
that'll
tank.
That'll be why in the third paragraph there they use the phrase minimum income guarantee, which is obviously used by, was it Scottish Labour folk a couple of weeks ago?
Yes, it was. Minimum income guarantee is the New Britain term for UBI, basically. Yes. 1 in 5 people in the UK are living in relative poverty.
You will spend your minimum income guarantee on the resources provided to you as part of your minimum infrastructure guarantee.
Well, this is part of a project. Everyone should be assured of a decent standard of living in one of the world's richest countries. That's why the New Economics Foundation are campaigning for a living income, an overhaul of our threadbare social security system, that no one falls below a level of income they need to meet everyday costs. But how should this be achieved in practice?
There's an interesting line there. Of the estimated 500,000 people who were eligible for universal credit at the start of the pandemic but didn't apply, 27% said they didn't because of stigma. So this is basically a government outlet putting forward the argument that it's bad that people had a sense of guilt about taking free money.
It's they have offered people the money printer money, and the people, whether they know it or not, have smelled a rat and said, I can't be seen to take this.
Not in good conscience.
Not in good conscience, no. But two potential approaches are universal basic income, UBI, or a minimum income guarantee, which is the same thing as UBI. UBI is a set regular payment from the government to every adult resident, while minimum income guarantee means that the state props up everyone's income that falls below a given level. What they're going to do is both.
Yes, which is the thing I was trying to say earlier on. Is that?
But there's no reason they can't work together.
That was the thing that was mentioned in the Conservative, the policy outlook that Rishi Sunak was referring when he originally talked about UBI a number of months ago now. They put forward the same thing, that UBI could be used as a wage guarantee tool. Which is the exact same thing they're talking about
here.
Yes,
and I believe this is a hand tip to what they're going to do.
Yes.
But I'm going to take you through some of the normalisation first. This is their living income vertical, which basically is just a project to promote the minimum income guarantee, basically saying they're going to top up people's wages in quote-unquote, you know, essential roles. They use the language of the pandemic here. They talk about the social security system not working. And it's all based on the same project, which is the minimum income standard. And they basically go around and say that they're going to basically figure out area by area what people need with their minimum infrastructure.
Scroll down a bit. What they got in the graphic there?
Yeah.
God. So this is their standardized sort of chart for it.
Yeah.
So they're going to reorientate everyone so that they sit on the right level, and everyone's got to be able to afford holidays and champagnes.
Well, the point is really that you will be in a subsistence mode, but the way they're selling this is through something that is already popular, accepted, and extolled by the Conservative Party, even in the UK, which is the living wage.
Yeah,
the living wage is something that was put forward by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and the Centre for Research and Social Policy. We've talked about both those before. It was put forward by those two as a first step. You know, well, people want a living wage. Well, what about a living income?
Yes.
And it's the ramping up from there. You agreed to basically an unlimited minimum wage, and then you agreed to an unlimited minimum income.
I think as well, it's also worth pointing out that they already deal with some of the logical...
Yeah.
The application problems you would have about the fact that, well, different regions require a different minimum income guarantee. Well, they'll just adjust it because they've already got an adjusted living wage for London compared to the rest of the UK.
Yes.
They're already talking about doing adjusted minimum wages for larger city centre areas in the UK.
I'll tell you how this will work because it's all interoperable. This will work on the case. This will work via a digital currency.
Mm-hmm.
It will work within your 50-minute city, and it will be calculated within your 50-minute city. You will have your minimum infrastructure guarantee. You will have your minimum income guarantee, and those two will be related to each other. It will be based on where you are and the price planning and the complex, you know, central calculation stuff that they do for your area. You are not really designed to go outside of, and they will tailor it to you there. Because if they tailor it to you there, you'll be further disincentivized from leaving your area.
Yeah. I think we can sort of come to a final kind of wrap up here.
Yeah, I'd say that the just a quick one. The minimum income guarantee is also put forward as a silver bullet for all gender and race based wage discrimination. Because if everyone who does the same job is on the same guaranteed income, then that completely solves all these supposed social issues.
No. What it means is. If you work at a job and you do, you know, 40 hours a week plus overtime, and some woman who you work with only does 35 because she takes a half day Thursday, Friday to pick up her kids,
yeah,
both of you'll get paid the same.
Yes.
But we'll wrap it up here. People who undertake less resource-intensive activities are being rewarded. That is like the paradigm of our age. And even more so as we move into climate control kind of stuff. This is the ultimate point of centrally planned resource allocation systems. Instead of increasing resources, there is a decrease to subsistence. We already see propaganda and advertising and TV programme about people engaging in climate action.
Yes.
And climate action is ultimately you choosing for one reason or another to do less. You see adverts about, Sandra's put in a charger for an electric car she just bought. Which is Sandra admitting the fact that she's going to drive less and do less, you know, compared to what she could have done before. I remember seeing a thing prior to the coronation. It was like Channel 5 or something like that in the afternoon, and they're interviewing the kids at a school. And like, if you had one policy, what would it be? And the kid they just decided to have on the news talking about it said, I would have a policy that means you wouldn't have to work Mondays. And you could not work on Monday as long as you did some aspect of climate action.
Yeah.
You're going to work less, do something for the climate, and that somehow makes it okay.
There will be a lot more. Like, it's going to get worse than you ever think they have the control system.
The further point, how far are we away from a climate strike?
Yes.
The logical end goal of virtuous unproductivity in the name of climate action that never ends. And they're already setting this up. I mean, you know, it's 2027. The dreaded 1.5 degrees C, you know, UN Paris Accord standard has been burst. It's all over. So Keir Starmer comes on over the emergency alert system in your phone and demands that things have gone too far and we can't let the bankers and the industrialists run the planet into the ground. So we must strike for the climate, i.e. a climate lockdown, under the proviso that there will be climate furlough or UBI or the minimum income guarantee, whatever they call it, it's going to be there and they're going to give people plenty enough reason to feel justified and also virtuous because they're putting their hands up and saying, I'm not working anymore.
Yes.
Which is also a nice little roundabout way for them to never have to deal with the terms of the fact that the work they were doing before wasn't real.
Well, it's also completely removes the social stigma they spoke about too.
Yes.
It becomes rather a vice. It becomes a virtue rather than a vice. It makes it so that people will do it reflexively if they think it will gain status. And ultimately, we're not going to talk about too much of the shape of the UBI system here, but once people are flattened into it, they will be dangled with status. That is really how it will work. I've got a few donations to read here before we round out though. Thank you, Fishy Frenzy, for the £5. He says, I'm going to get a real job. I'm going to become a politician.
Yes.
Very funny. Coney Current Year, how many jobs in hospitality do you think are fake? You'd have to basically turn the money printer off and see you still has a job. EC90 says, maybe fully automated luxury communism would be okay. And there's a funny one above that from Epic Ninja making a good point saying, all I'm saying is a recession in an economy with, I guess you mean subsistence level UBI, is just a famine.
Yes. See, this is the thing, though, is that Stalin and Lenin, they had the honesty to stick their hands up and go, no kulaks, die now. But now we have to pretend that our elites are doing a favour for us for kulakization.
Once again, thank you to everyone who turned up today. I hope we've explained ourselves fully. I hope you understand kind of where we're coming from in the premise that UBI, from the standpoint of the managerialists, is just objectively superior in their minds to the tangled system they've created now. And really, a lot of the policy they're creating has a UBI and minimum infrastructure guarantee shaped
and
hole in it.
As we have discussed before, the only way to make the UBI immigration complex work out in the end is digital ID and digital currency.
Yeah, that is the only way this can be administered centrally. Bonkers Boris Bugs paste. Once again, I will do a little bit of shilling. Do interact with the videos. Do drop a comment if you're watching the VOD, or do drop us a like. It does help, and it does mean that you'll see these again. If you do want to support us, we are still monetized. Or you can give via the PayPal, which is in the pinned comment. Or you can become a member, which is the best way to support on a recurring basis. Or you can just show up and support us, which helps too.
I would appreciate if people were to share this one round, because I've basically seen almost nobody talk about UBI in this sort of line of argument, so I'd be interested to see what sort of wider reception this framework gets.
From my point, I would say that if they were to come out and say that UBI is superior to the terrible patchwork system we have currently, technically they're correct, but they're the ones who create the terrible patchwork system.
Well, yeah, and as Connie Current News said there, he's hoping to see you guys at Manchester. We will make sure that hopefully by Friday, those who are interested in knowing where we're going to be on that weekend in Manchester, you will find out.
Yes.
So either email us on the Nomos email, or contact us via the Discord or the Telegram, or DMs with, you know, ticket numbers and this, that, and the next thing. And we'll make sure that the venues we're at on both the Friday and the Saturday get out to you.
Yes. Again, thank you guys for coming. I hope this wasn't too depressing when, you know, you've got your daily dose from the...
I am the black pill dinner lady.
You are the black pill dinner lady. So we will say many thanks for the watchings, and have a good night, folks. Good night, Evelyn.
Good night.